I heard the silky rub of her stockings against each other and breathed in a fresh breath of her perfume every time she moved. That perfume had a certain effect on me.
This week on Selected Shorts, Young Lust and Second Lives.
In my next life, I want to explain homecoming to someone enthusiastically. I want to understand what it means to say that something is the size of a football field.
Hi, I'm Isaiah Sheffer, and you're listening to Selected Shorts from PRI, the program that brings you great contemporary short fiction read live on stage at Symphony Space in New York City and in other venues across the country. To this program, we give the overall title Growing Up Fast, because it consists of two American tales of young people rather abruptly experiencing events and feelings that move them in a big leap towards adulthood and maturity, for better or for worse. The first story we'll hear is Tobias Wolff's Smorgasbord, a tale of some young men at a prep school who are taken out to dinner by the mother of one of their classmates. In addition to the meal, the awkward and emotionally fraught occasion furnishes them with a rather chilling insight into how things can be with grown-ups. I'm here with our literary commentator, Hannah Tinty, of One Story Magazine.
Well, this story is set in a prep school, and I often tell my students that being a good writer is really about being a good liar. When it comes to lying, Tobias Wolff is an expert. When he was 15, he applied to a prestigious prep school and wrote all the letters of recommendation himself. And he did it so well that he got a scholarship. And he was, of course, later found out and forced to leave school, but it's a testament to his sharp skills as a writer.
As a fiction writer.
That's right. He won the Ray Award for the short story, and his most recent collection is Our Story Begins. One of the teachers in Smorgasbord tells his students they should not be in too great a hurry to lose their innocence. It becomes a joke, but in truth, this warning resonates as the boys make their way through most of the seven deadly sins.
Right.
Gluttony, lust, pride, greed, and envy, with even a little sloth and wrath thrown in. By the end of the story, the narrator has lost something really valuable, and I don't just mean his virginity. It's something deeper than that. It's how he looks at the world.
That's right. Well, before we hear Smorgasbord read for us, I should point out that parental guidance may be applicable here, since the story does contain some language and some descriptions of teenage sexual and other escapades. The story is read for us by the always compelling veteran Selected Shorts performer, René Aubergenois.
A prep school in March is like a ship in the doldrums. Our history master said this as if to himself while we were waiting for the bell to ring after class. He stood by the window and tapped the glass with his ring in a dreamy, abstracted way, meant to make us think he'd forgotten we were there. We were supposed to get the impression that when we weren't around, he turned into someone interesting, someone witty and profound who uttered impromptu bon mots and had a poetic vision of life. The bell rang. I went to lunch. The dining hall was almost empty because it was a free weekend and most of the boys in school had gone to New York or home or to their friends' homes as soon as their last class let out. About the only ones left were foreigners and scholarship students like me, and a few other untouchables of various stripes. The school had laid on a nice lunch for us, cheese souffle, but the portions were small, and I went back to my room still hungry. I was always hungry. Snow and rain fell past my window. The snow on the quad looked grimy. It had melted above the underground heating pipes, exposing long brown lines of mud. I couldn't get to work. On the next floor down, someone kept playing Mac the Knife. That one song incessantly repeating itself made the dorm seem not just empty, but abandoned, as if those who had left were never coming back. I cleaned my room. I tried to read. I looked out the window. I sat down at my desk and studied the new picture of my girlfriend, the one she had sent me, unable to imagine her from it. I had to close my eyes to do that, and then I could see her solemn eyes and the heavy white breasts she would gravely let me hold sometimes, but not kiss. Not yet, anyway. But I had a promise. That summer, as soon as I got home, we were going to become lovers. Become lovers. That was how she said it, very deliberately, listening to the words as she spoke them. All year I had repeated them to myself to take the edge off my loneliness and the fits of lust that made me want to scream and drive my fists through the walls. We were going to become lovers that summer, and we were going to be lovers all through college, true to each other, even if we ended up thousands of miles apart. And after college, we were going to marry and join the Peace Corps and then do something together that would help people. This was our plan. Back in September, the night before I left for school, we wrote it all down, along with a lot of other specifics concerning our future, number of children, six, their names, the kinds of dogs we would own, a sketch of our perfect house. We sealed the paper in a bottle and buried it in her backyard. On our golden anniversary, we were going to dig it up again and show it to our children and grandchildren to prove that dreams can come true. I was writing her a letter when Crossley came to my room. Crossley was a science whiz. He won the science prize every year and spent his summers working as an intern in different laboratories. He was also a fanatical weightlifter. His arms were so knotty that he had to hold them out from his sides as he walked, as if he were carrying buckets. Even his features seemed muscular. His face was red. Crossley lived down the hall by himself in one of the only singles in the school. He was said to be a thief. That supposedly was the reason he'd ended up without a roommate. I didn't know if it was true, and I tried to avoid forming an opinion on the matter, but whenever we passed each other, I felt embarrassed and dropped my eyes. Crossley leaned in the door and asked me how things were. I said, okay. He stepped inside and looked around the room, tilting his head to read my roommate's penance and the titles of our books. I was uneasy. I said, so what can I do for you? Not meaning to sound as cold as I did, but not exactly regretting it either. He caught my tone and smiled. It was the kind of smile you put on when you pass a group of people you suspect are talking about you. It was his usual expression. He said, you know Garcia, right? Garcia, sure. I think so. You know him, Crossley said. He runs around with Hidalgo and those guys. He's the tall one. Sure, I said. I know who Garcia is. Well, his stepmother is in New York for a fashion show or something, and she's going to drive up and take him out to dinner tonight. She told him to bring along some friends. You want to come? What about Hidalgo and the rest of them? Now, they're at some kind of polo deal in Maryland, buying horses or ponies, I guess it would be. The notion of someone my age buying ponies to play a game with was so unexpected, I couldn't quite take it in. Jesus, I said. Crossley said, how about it? You want to come? I'd never even spoken to Garcia. He was the nephew of a famous dictator, and all his friends were nephews and cousins of other dictators. They lived as they pleased here. Most of them kept cars a few blocks from the campus, though it was completely against the rules, and I'd heard that some of them kept women as well. They were cocky and prankish and charming. They moved everywhere in a body with sunglasses pushed up on their heads and jackets slung over their shoulders, twittering all at once like birds, chinga this and chinga that. The headmaster was completely buffaloed. After Christmas vacation, a bunch of them came down with gonorrhea. And all he did was call them in and advise them that they should not be in too great a hurry to lose their innocence. It became a school joke. All you had to do was say the word innocence, and everyone would crack up. I don't know, I said. Come on, Crosley said. But I don't even know the guy. So what? I don't either. Well, then why did he ask you? Well, I was sitting next to him at lunch. Terrific, I said. That explains you. What about me? How come he asked me? He didn't. He told me to bring someone else. What, just anybody? Just whoever happened to present himself to your attention? Crosley shrugged. I laughed. Crosley gave me a look to make sure I wasn't laughing at him. Then he laughed, too. Sounds great, I said. Sounds like a recipe for a really memorable evening. Well, you got something better to do? Crosley asked. No, I said. The limousine picked us up under the awning of the headmaster's house. The driver, an old man, got out slowly and then slowly adjusted his cap before opening the door for us. Garcia slid in beside the woman in back. Crosley and I sat across from them on seats that pulled down. I caught her scent immediately. For some years afterward, I brought perfume for women, and I was never able to find that one. Garcia erupted into Spanish as soon as the driver closed the door behind me. He sounded angry, spitting words at the woman and gesticulating violently. She rocked back a little, then let loose a burst of her own. I stared openly at her. Her skin was very white. She wore a black cape over a black dress, cut just low enough to show her pale throat and the bones at the base of her throat. Her mouth was red. There was a spot of rouge high on each cheek, not rubbed in to look like real color, but left there carelessly or carefully to make you think again how white her skin was. Her teeth were small and sharp-looking, and she bared them in concert with certain gestures and inflections. As she talked, her little pointed tongue flicked in and out. She wasn't a lot older than we were, 25 at most, maybe younger. She said something definitive and cut her hand through the air. Garcia began to answer her, but she said, "No!" and chopped the air again. Then she turned and smiled at Crosley and me. It was a completely false smile. She said, "Where would you fellows like to eat?" Her voice sounded lower in English, even a little harsh, though the harshness could have come from her accent. She called us fellows. "Anywhere is fine with me," I said. "Anywhere," she repeated. She narrowed her big black eyes and pushed her lips together. I could see that my answer disappointed her. She looked at Crosley. "Well, there's supposed to be a good French restaurant in Newbury," Crosley said. "Also an Italian place. It depends on what you want." "No," she said. "It depends on what you want. I am not so hungry." If Garcia had a preference, he kept it to himself. He sulked in the corner, his round shoulders slumped and his hands between his knees. He seemed to be trying to make a point of some kind. "There's also a smorgasbord," Crosley said, "if you like smorgasbords."
"Smorgasbord," she said.
She repeated the word to Garcia. He frowned, then answered her in a sullen monotone. I couldn't believe Crosley had suggested the smorgasbord. It was an egregiously uncouth suggestion. The smorgasbord was where the local fatties went to binge. Football coaches brought whole teams there to bulk up. The food was good enough, and God knows there was plenty of it. All you could eat, actually, but the atmosphere was brutally matter of fact. The food was good, though. Big platters of shrimp on crushed ice, barons of beef, smoked turkey. No end of food, really. She was smiling. Obviously, the concept was new to her.
"You, did you like smorgasbords?" she asked crossly.
Yes, he said.
And you? She said to me. I nodded. Then, not to seem wishy-washy, I said, you bet.
Smorgasbord, she said.
She laughed and clapped her hands.
Smorgasbord.
Crossley gave directions to the driver, and we drive slowly away from the school. She said something to Garcia. He nodded at each of us in turn and gave our names, then looked away again out the window where the snowy fields were turning dark. His face was long, his eyes sorrowful as hounds. He had barely talked to us while we were waiting for the limousine. I didn't know why he was mad at his stepmother, or why he wouldn't talk to us, or why he'd even asked us along. But by now, I didn't really care. By now, my sentiments were basically him. She studied us and repeated our names skeptically.
No, she said.
She pointed at Crossley and said,
El Blanco.
She pointed to me and said,
El Negro.
Then she pointed at herself and said,
I am Linda.
Linda, Crossley said. He really overdid it. But she showed her sharp little teeth and said, Exactamente. Then she settled back against the seat and pulled her cape close around her shoulders. It soon fell open again. She was restless. She sat forward and leaned back, crossed and recrossed her legs, swung her feet impatiently. She had on black high heels fastened by a thin strap. I could see almost her entire foot. I heard the silky rub of her stockings against each other and breathed in a fresh breath of her perfume every time she moved. That perfume had a certain effect on me. It didn't reach me as just a smell. It was personal. It seemed to issue from her very privacy. It made the hair bristle on my arms. It entered my veins like fine tingling wires, widening my eyes, tightening my spine, sending faint chills across my shoulders and the backs of my knees. Every time she moved, I felt a little tug and followed her motion with some slight motion of my own. When we arrived at the smorgasbord, Swenson's, I believe it was, or maybe Hansen's, some such honest Swede of a name, Garcia refused to get out of the limousine. Linda tried to persuade him, but he shrank back into his corner and would not answer or even look at her. She threw up her hands. Ah, she said, and turned away. Crossley and I followed her across the parking lot toward the big red barn. Her dress rustled as she walked. Her heels clicked on the cement. You could say one thing for the smorgasbord. It wasn't pretentious. It was in a real barn, not some quaint fantasy of a barn with butter churn lamps and little brass ornaments nailed to the walls on strips of leather. At one end of the barn was the kitchen. The rest of it had been left open and filled with picnic tables. Blazing light bulbs hung from the rafters. In the middle of the barn stood what my English master would have called the groaning board. A great table heaped with food, every kind of food you could think of, and more. I had been there several times, and it always gave me a small, pleasant shock to see how much food there was. Girls wearing dirndls hustled around the barn, cleaning up messes, changing tablecloths, bringing fresh platters of food from the kitchen. We stood blinking in the sudden light. Linda paid up, then we followed one of the waitresses across the floor. Linda walked slowly, gazing around like a tourist. Several men looked up from their food as she passed. I was behind her, and I looked forbiddingly back at them so they would think she was my wife. We were lucky. We got a table to ourselves. On crowded nights, they usually doubled you up with another party, and that could be an extremely unromantic experience. Linda shrugged off her cape and waved us toward the food. Go on, she said. She sat down and opened her purse. When I looked back, she was lighting a cigarette. You're pretty quiet tonight, Crossley said as we filled our plates. You p pissed off or something? I shook my head. Well, maybe I'm just quiet, Crosley, you know? He speared a slice of meat and said, "And when she called you El Negro, that didn't mean she thought you were a Negro. She just said that because your hair is dark. Mine is light. That's how come she called me El Blanco." "I know that, Crosley. Jesus, you think I couldn't figure that out? Give me some credit, okay?" Then, as we moved around the table, I said, "You speak Spanish?" "Un poco. Actually, more like un poquito." "What's Garcia mad about?" "Money. Something about money." "Like what?" He shook his head. "That's all I could get. But it's definitely about money." I'd meant to start off slow, but by the time I reached the end of the table, my plate was full. Potato salad, ham, jumbo shrimp, toast, barbecued beef, eggs, Benny. Crosley's was full, too. We walked back toward Linda, who was leaning forward on her elbows and looking around the barn. She took a long drag off her cigarette, lifted her chin, and blew a stream of smoke up toward the rafters. I sat down across from her. "Scoot down," Crosley said, and settled in beside me. She watched us eat for a while. "So," she said, "El Blanco, are you from New York?" Crosley looked up in surprise. "No, ma'am," he said. I'm from Virginia." Linda stabbed out her cigarette. She had long fingernails painted the same deep red as the lipstick smears on her cigarette butt. She said, "I just came from New York, and I can tell you that is one crazy place. Just incredible. Listen to this. I am in a taxi cab, you know, and we are stopping in this traffic jam for a long time. And there is a taxi cab next to us with this fellow in it who stares at me like this, you know?" She made her eyes go round. "Of course I ignore him. So, guess what? My door opens and he gets into my cab. 'Excuse me,' he says, 'I want to marry you.' 'That's nice,' I say. 'Ask my husband.' 'I don't care about your husband,' he says. 'Your husband is history.' 'So is my wife.' Of course I had to laugh. 'Okay,' he says. 'Do you think that's funny? How about this?' Then he says..." Linda looked sharply at each of us, sniffed, and made a face. "He says things you would never believe, never. He wants to do this, he wants to do that. Well, I act like I am about to scream. I open my mouth like this. 'Hey,' he says, 'okay, okay, relax.' Then he gets out and goes back to his taxi cab. We are still sitting there for a long, long time. And you know what he is doing? He is reading the newspaper with his hat on. 'Go ahead, eat,' she said to us and nodded toward the food. A tall, blonde girl was carving slices of roast beef onto a platter. She smiled at us. She was hale and bosomy. I could see the laces on her bodice straining. Her cheeks glowed. Her bare arms and shoulders were ruddy with exertion. Crosley raised his eyebrows at me. I raised mine back, but my heart wasn't in it. She was a Viking dream, pure Gemütlichkeit. But I was drunk on Garcia's stepmother. And in that condition, you don't want a glass of milk. You want more of what's making you stumble and fall. Crosley and I filled our plates again and headed back. "I'm always hungry," he said. "I know what you mean," I told him. Linda smoked another cigarette while we ate. She watched the other tables as if she were at a movie. I tried to eat with a little finesse, and so did Crosley, dabbing his lips with a napkin between every bulging mouthful. But some of the people around us had completely slipped their moorings. They ducked their heads low to receive their food, and while they chewed it up, they looked around suspiciously and kept their forearms close to their plates. A big family to our left was the worst. There was something competitive and desperate about them. They seemed to be eating their way toward a condition where they would never have to eat again. You would have thought that they were refugees from a great hunger, that outside these walls the land was afflicted with drought and barrenness. I felt a kind of desperation myself. I felt as if I were growing emptier with every bite I took. There was a din in the air, a steady roar like that of a waterfall. Linda looked around her with a pleased expression. She bore no likeness to anyone here, but she seemed completely at home. She sent us back for another plate, then dessert and coffee, and while we were finishing up, she asked El Blanco if he had a girlfriend. "No, ma'am," Crossley said. "We broke up," he added, and his red face turned purple. It was clear he was lying.
"Ju, how about you?"
I nodded.
"Ha," she said. "El Negro is the one. So, what's her name?"
"Jane."
"Jane," Linda drawled. "Okay, let's hear about Jane."
"Jane," I said again. Linda smiled. I told her everything. I told her how my girlfriend and I had met and what she looked like and what our plans were. I told her more than everything because I gave certain coy but definite suggestions about the extremities to which our passion had already driven us. I meant to impress her with my potency, to inflame her, to wipe that smile off her face. But the more I told her, the more wolfishly she smiled and the more her eyes laughed at me. Laughing eyes. Now, there's a cliche my English master would have eaten me alive for. "How exactly did these eyes laugh?" he would have asked, looking up from my paper while my classmates snorted around me. "Did they titter, or did they merely chortle? Did they give a great guffaw? Did they perhaps scream with laughter?" I am here to tell you that eyes can scream with laughter. Linda's did. As I played big hombre for her, I could see exactly how complete my failure was. I could hear her saying, "Okay, El Negro, gone. Talk about your little girlfriend, how pretty she is, and so on. But we know what you want, don't we? You want to suck on my tongue and slobber on my teeth. And lick my belly and buried your face in me. That's what you want." Crossley interrupted me. "Ma'am," he said, and nodded toward the door. Garcia was leaning there with his arms crossed and an expression of fury on his face. When she looked at him, he turned and walked out the door. Her eyes went flat. She sat there for a moment. She began to take a cigarette from her case, then put it back and stood up. "Let's go," she said. Garcia was waiting in the car, rigid and silent. He said nothing on the drive back. Linda swung her foot and stared out the window at the passing houses and bright moonlit fields. Just before we reached the school, Garcia leaned forward and began speaking to her in a low voice. She listened impassively and did not answer. He was still talking when the limousine stopped in front of the headmaster's house. The driver opened the door. Garcia fixed her with his eyes. Still impassive, she took her pocketbook out of her purse. She opened it and looked inside. She meditated over the contents, then withdrew a bill and offered it to Garcia. It was a $100 bill. "Bullshit," he said, and sat back angrily. With no change of expression, she turned and held the bill out to me. I didn't know what else to do but take it. She got another one from her pocket and presented it to Crossley, who hesitated even less than I did. Then she gave us the same false smile she had greeted us with and said, "Good night. It was a pleasure to meet you. Good night," she said to Garcia. The three of us got out of the limousine. I went a few paces and then slowed down and began to look back.
"Keep walking," Crossley hissed.
Garcia let off a string of words as the driver closed the door. I faced around again and walked with Crossley across the quad. As we approached our dorm, he quickened his pace. "I don't believe it," he whispered. $100! When we were inside the door, he stopped and shouted, $100! $100 f***ing bucks! "Pipe down," someone yelled. All right, you," he added. We went up the stairs to our floor, laughing and banging into each other. "Do you f***ing believe it?" he said. I shook my head. We were standing outside my door. "No, I mean, really, now listen." He put his hands on my shoulders and looked into my eyes. He said, "Do you f***ing believe it?" I told him I didn't. "Well, neither do I. I don't f***ing believe it." There didn't seem to be much to say after that. I would have invited Crosley in, but to tell the truth, I still thought of him as a thief. We laughed a few more times and said goodnight. My room was cold. I took the bill out of my pocket and looked at it. It was new and stiff, the kind of bill you associate with kidnappings. The picture of Franklin was surprisingly lifelike. I looked at it for a while. $100 was a lot of money then. I had never had $100 before, not in one chunk like this. To be on the safe side, I taped it to a page in Profiles in Courage, page 100, so I wouldn't forget where it was. I had trouble getting to sleep. The food I had eaten sat like a stone in me, and I was miserable about the things I had said. I understood that I had been a liar and a fool. I kept shifting under the covers. Then I sat up and turned on my reading lamp. I picked up the new picture my girlfriend had sent me and closed my eyes. And when I had some peace of mind, I renewed my promises to her. We broke up a month after I got home. Her parents were away one night, and we seized the opportunity to make love in their canopied bed. This was the fifth time that we had made love. She got up immediately afterward and started putting her clothes on. When I asked her what the problem was, she wouldn't answer. I thought, oh, Christ, what now? "Come on," I said. "What's the problem?" She was tying her shoes. She looked up and said, "You don't love me." It surprised me to hear this, not because she said it, but because it was true. Before this moment, I hadn't known it was true, but it was. I didn't love her. For a long time afterward, I told myself that I had never really loved her, but this was a lie. We're supposed to smile at the passions of the young and at what we recall of our own passions, as if they were no more than a series of sweet frauds we had fooled ourselves with and then wised up to. Not only the passions of boys and girls for each other, but the others too. Passion for justice, for doing right, for turning the world around. All these come in their time under our wintry smiles. But there was nothing foolish about what we felt. Nothing merely young. I just wasn't up to it. I let the light go out. Sometime later, I heard a soft knock at my door. I was still wide awake. "Yeah," I said. Crosley stepped inside. He was wearing a blue dressing gown of some silky material that shimmered in the dim light of the hallway. He said, "Have you got any Tums or anything?" "No, I wish I did. You too, huh?" He closed the door and sat on my roommate's bunk. "Do you feel as bad as I do?" "How bad do you feel?" "Like I'm dying. I think there was something wrong with the shrimp." "Oh, come on, Crosley. You ate everything but the barn." "So did you." "That's right. That's why I'm not complaining." He moaned and rocked back and forth on the bed. I could hear real pain in his voice. I sat up. "Crosley, are you okay?" "I guess," he said. "You want me to call the nurse?" "God," he said. "No, that's all right." He kept rocking. Then, in a carefully offhand way, he said, Look, is it okay if I just stay here for a while? I almost said no. Then I caught myself. Sure, I told him. Make yourself at home. He must have heard my hesitation. Forget it, he said bitterly. Sorry I asked. But he made no move to go. I felt confused, tender toward Crossley because he was in pain, repelled because of what I had heard about him. But maybe what I had heard about him wasn't true. I wanted to be fair, so I said, "Hey, Crossley, do you mind if I ask you a question?" "That depends." I sat up. Crossley was watching me. In the moonlight, his dressing gown was iridescent as oil. He had his arms crossed over his stomach. "Is it true that you got caught stealing?" "You f***er," he said. He looked down at the floor. I waited. He said, "You want to hear about it? Just ask someone. Everybody knows all about it, right?" "I don't." "That's right. You don't." He raised his head. "You don't know shit about it, and neither does anyone else." He tried to smile. His teeth appeared almost luminous in the cold silver light. "The really hilarious part is I didn't actually get caught stealing it. I got caught putting it back, not to make excuses. I stole the f***er, all right." "Stole what?" "The coat," he said. "Robinson's overcoat. Don't tell me you didn't know that." I shook my head. "Well, then you must have been living in a cave or something. You know Robinson, right? Robinson was my roommate. He had this camel's hair overcoat, this really beautiful overcoat. I kind of got obsessed with it. I thought about it all the time. Whenever he went somewhere without it, I would put it on and stand in front of the mirror. Then one day I just took the f***er. I stuck it in my locker over at the gym. Robinson was really upset. He'd go to his closet 10, 20 times a day like he thought the coat had just gone for a walk or something. So anyway, I brought it back. He came into the room while I was hanging it up. Crossley bent forward suddenly, then leaned back. "You're lucky they didn't kick you out." "I wish they had," he said. "The dean wanted to play Jesus. He got all choked up over the fact that I had brought it back." Crossley rubbed his arms. "Man, did I want that coat. It was ridiculous how much I wanted that coat, you know?" He looked right at me. "Do you know what I'm talking about?" I nodded. "Really?" "Yes." "Good." Crossley lay back against the pillow, then lifted his feet onto the bed. "Say," he said, "I think I figured out how come Garcia invited me." "Yeah? How come?" "He was mad at his stepmother, right? He wanted to punish her." "So?" "So I'm the punishment. He probably heard I was the biggest asshole in the school and figured whoever came with me would have to be an asshole too. That's my theory anyway." I started laughing. It hurt my stomach, but I couldn't stop. Crossley said, "Come on, man, don't make me laugh." Then he started laughing and moaning at the same time. We lay without talking for a time. Crossley said, "El Negro." "Yeah? What are you going to do with your C note? "I don't know. What are you going to do?" "Buy a woman." "Buy a woman? I haven't gotten laid in a really long time. In fact," he said, "I've never gotten laid." "Me either." I thought about his words. Buy a woman. He could actually do it. I could do it myself. I didn't have to wait. I didn't have to burn like this for month after month until Jane decided she was ready to give me relief. 3 months was a long time to wait. It was an unreasonable time to wait for anything if you had no good reason to wait, if you could just buy what you needed. And to think that you could buy this, buy a mouth for your mouth and arms and legs to wrap you tight. I had never considered this before. I thought of the money in my book. I could almost feel it there. Pure possibility. Jane would never know. It wouldn't hurt her at all. And in a certain way, it might help, because it was going to be very awkward at first if neither of us had any experience. As a man, I should know what I was doing. It would be a lot better that way. I told Crossley that I liked his idea. "The time has come to lose our innocence," I said. "Exactamente," he said. And so we sat up and took counsel, leaning toward each other from the beds, holding our swollen bellies, whispering back and forth about how this thing might be done, and where, and when.
René Auberjonois read Tobias Wolff's story, Smorgasbord. We'll take a very quick break and then hear a story about homecoming. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide, from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. For more information about the stories you're hearing or about the readers who are reading them, please go to selectedshorts.org or to wnyc.org/shorts. Elizabeth Crane, the author of our next story, lives in Austin, Texas, and has published three collections of stories, When the Messenger is Hot, All This Heavenly Glory, and You Must Be This Happy to Enter. This year, Harper Perennial is coming out with her debut novel entitled We Only Know So Much.
Elizabeth Crane says that she decided to be a writer after reading Harriet the Spy, but she's also heavily influenced by David Foster Wallace. She's known for doing a lot of fun and imaginative things with language. Footnotes, lists, parenthetical statements, long sentences, and repetitions, as she does in today's story, football. Now, Elizabeth Crane grew up in New York City, so it's interesting that football is an American small-town fantasy. It's this idea of what you would do in your next life.
We'll now hear Elizabeth Crane's story, Football, read at the Steppenwolf Theater in Chicago by its artistic director, Martha Levy.
In my next life, I want to explain homecoming to someone enthusiastically. I want to understand what it means to say that something is the size of a football field, and I want an older brother named Jimmy who plays tight end, and I want to know the names of all the players, and I want them to carry me over their heads to the bus, and I want to eat pizza with them after the game. I want to go to all the home games and all the away games and wear blue eyeliner and use sun in. And I want to make out under the bleachers, and I want to wear the halfback's jacket. I want to squint into the bright lights and bring a thick plaid blanket and something hot in a thermos. And I want to see my breath as I scream, rah, or woo, or go team for the Tigers or the Hawks or the Wildcats. I want Jimmy to get a football scholarship to state, and I want to call my dad Pop, and I want to beg Pop to lend me his pickup to drive downstate to my brother's games, and when Jimmy gets suspended from the team for being involved in an incident with a co-ed and swears he wasn't involved in the incident, I want to believe him, and when he drives his car into a telephone pole at 90 miles an hour and says it was an accident, I want to believe him then, too, no matter how sad he looks to be awake the next day. I want to tell Jimmy everything's going to be okay, and I want to tell him this for 15 years while he goes from job to job and leaves town and comes back. And when Jimmy straightens up, so to speak, and joins a church and marries a girl from the church who always smiles, I want to tell him I'm proud of him, even though his eyes look flat now. Like Jimmy skipped class and he's not coming back. I want my pop to almost not go to their wedding because it's a dry wedding, because of the godforsaken fundamentalist horse crap church Jimmy belongs to. And I want my mom to ride out the storm like she always does, and I want her to cry at their wedding into Pop's hanky. And after the ceremony, I want Pop to nod a reluctant approval at Jimmy and shake his hand so no one thinks he's gay. I want Pop to dance with Mom at the wedding, and I want her to smile at him like she did at their wedding, and I want him to tilt his head just the teeniest bit so he knows, she knows he feels the same way, but no one else does. I want to lose my virginity in a car to a troubled boy named Cliff. But I want to marry my high school sweetheart, Bill. I want the great sadness of my teenage life to be my brief pre-junior prom breakup with Bill. And I want to throw on my slightly ill-fitting white one-shouldered prom dress at the last minute when Bill shows up in a white tuxedo with a white limo and a white corsage and begs forgiveness. I want to maintain a solid B-plus average, and when I graduate, I want to go to typing school to have something to fall back on. And I want to work at the local life insurance company where they award me a plaque that says Secretary of the Month, 3 months in a row. But even when they raise me 6%, I want to quit after 9 months to be a homemaker. I want Bill to have a dream of moving to Hollywood to be a stuntman. And I want Bill to give up his dream because he loves me. And I want him to buy me a ring from Zales and propose after the lobster buffet on the deck of the casino boat in the next town over. I want to wear a lacy dress with a long train to my wedding, and I want my mom to put her pearl earrings on me for something borrowed and choke back tears when she says, "But you can forget to give them back." And I want flower girls and 6 bridesmaids, and I want my wedding photo taken at Sears, and I want that photo to be in the paper, and I want the word nay to be in the copy in front of my maiden name. I want my house to have a cement patio in back and pink impatiens on the front lawn and a basketball hoop over the garage. I want Bill to have tools in the garage so he can fix things. And I want him to work long hours and put off fixing things. And when he comes home late, I want to fix him warmed up meatloaf with extra ketchup, almost burnt the way he likes it. I want him to make love to me once a month and not try any funny stuff. Until he tries some funny stuff and I really like it. And then I want him to make love to me twice a month. And I want to tell my girlfriends about it. I want Bill to flirt with a woman from out of town who supplies parts for his business, and I want him to come close to having an affair, but I want him to remember how much he loves me in the lounge at the Marriott and to tell the almost other woman he was about to make a terrible mistake. And I want him to cancel her account. I want to suspect this is going on, and then I want to tell myself I'm wrong. I want to serve dip and pretzels and schlitz in cans to my husband Bill and his buddies while they watch the Super Bowl and holler at the TV like it can hear them. And while I sit on the stoop and smoke my one stale cigarette of the week from my gold vinyl cigarette case under the almost dark 5 o'clock sky and look at the fast moving clouds and sitting there, I want to think, life is good. I want to live where there's nothing to do, where people join bowling leagues and chain smoke and drink too much and get into fights at bars or get pregnant at the wrong time or by the wrong guy and dream of getting out. I want to read books by V.C. Andrews, and I want to watch Friends every night at 6 and laugh and be glad I don't live in New York. And I want to subscribe to People, and I want to meet Tom Cruise. I want to run into my girlfriends at the market and catch up on gossip in the soup aisle. And I want to have a girl named Jenny. And I want 2 boys, one named Joe and one named Jason. And I want my girl to skin her knees in the street. And I want Joe to play catch with Bill. And I want Jason to play with Jenny's Barbies more than Jenny does. And I want them all to bring home ribbons for something. And I want to see their pictures in the paper with the ribbons, and I want them to fight over riding shotgun and who got a bigger piece of pie. I want to use the word varsity. I want Jenny and Joe and Jason to be on the varsity anything. And in spite of what Bill says, I want to not assume that my son is gay because he's on varsity cheerleading. And I want to say to Bill something like, and anyway, what if he is? I want Jenny to have a canopy bed and posters of boy bands and eat one lettuce leaf for dinner. And I want her to join a program and gain the weight back and go on a talk show so she can help others. And when she's 14 and meets a cute goth boy, I want her to rip her boy band posters down during a fight with me, in which she says that's not who she is anymore, even though she kind of obviously is, but doesn't want to be because of the goth boy. And later, I want to find the posters neatly rolled up in the back of the closet and know that I was right. I want Jenny to sneak out at night to meet the goth boy and go almost all the way with him on his black satin cape that he's laid down by the lake, but then decide she can't go through with it. And after high school, I want to send her to school to be a dental hygienist or a real estate agent or a hotel manager. I want Jason to work after school so he can afford helmet-lang pants. I want Bill to say, "Helmet who?" indignantly. And when Jason finally comes out to us at 16, even though it's been pretty obvious since the Barbies, I want Bill to almost disown him, but later I want to find Bill on the internet looking up P-flag on Google. And I want him to take photos of Jason pinning a boutonniere on his prom date, Todd. I want Joe to wreck his dad's Mustang on the day he gets his license, and I want him to be fine. But I want him to want something that isn't in our town, but not to know what. And I want to tell him he doesn't know what because there's nothing to know and that everything good is here. I want him to be the troubled boy that some hopeful girl loves but can't have. I want to send him to rehab twice before he turns 17 and tell him I'm sorry if I messed him up. And I want him to say, it was no one's fault. And I want him to fill notebooks with his feelings and write stories about big cities and show them to no one. And I want a hand-painted sign on Main Street to say, Bill and Son. I want Jason to move to New York to become a fashion stylist and commentator on E! And I want Jenny to get engaged to my best friend's son, and I want Joe to get his girlfriend pregnant. And I want Pop to freak out and say he's not going to the wedding, and why can't there be a wedding without shame? And I want Mom to talk him down because Joe really does love her. And I want Pop to shake Joe's hand at the wedding the way he does, and I want to wear a tasteful suit to both weddings. And I want Bill to cry at Jenny's wedding and pretend he isn't. I want Mom to die of old age or heart attack or anything but cancer. And I want Pop to die in his sleep a few months later. And I want to tell people he died from a broken heart. And I want them to nod when I say it. And I want to bury Mom and Pop together by the church and put daisies on their graves once a month and tell them about Jason and Jenny and Joe. And I want to know without a doubt that they're always with me. I want to have lots of grandchildren with more J names like Jordan and Jesse and Jeremy. And when they come to visit, I want to feed them burgers and tater tots and whole milk. And if they eat macrobiotic at home, I want Bill to shake his head. And I want to say, well, they're in my home now. And I want to fill their Christmas stockings with candy canes and trucks and action figures. I want to take care of Bill when he gets sick. And before he dies, I want to say, it was great, wasn't it? And I want him to say, it was. And after Bill dies, I want to hear that Cliff has overcome his troubles and that he's back in town.
And I want to start wearing lipstick again in case I run into Cliff. And I want to run into Cliff at the market and say, oh, hi, Cliff. I didn't know you were back in town. And twirl my hair and my fingers like I'm not someone's grandmother. And I want to meet him for a soda and listen to his stories of the big city and be glad I never left. I want to start seeing Cliff again and take bus tours of Spain and France with him on senior discounts and call him my gentleman friend. And eat croissants with young couples on their honeymoons and tell them stories that begin with back in the day. And I want the kids to wonder if Cliff and I share a room or not. And when I get sick, I want Cliff to take care of me and say, I'm sorry. I'm so, so sorry for being such a brooding cliche back in the day, because I know I really missed out. And when I say there's nothing to be sorry for and that it all worked out for the best, I want him to say he's sorry anyway. And I want the kids to come and say tender goodbyes before I close my eyes for good. I want my next life to be slow motion-y, with moody skies and grandpas tossing footballs and heirlooms passed down and really good hair and poignant background music. I want it to be like the 50s or the 70s or maybe even the 80s or maybe even some future decade where things are like they used to be, but in a new way. In my next life, I want to accept things as they are. And when people ask why, I want to say, what do you mean, why? And when everyone comes back for homecoming, I want to be already home.
Martha Levy read Football by Elizabeth Crane. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The president of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott, and the artistic director of Symphony Space is Laura Kaminsky. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Jim Briggs III. Our guest commentator is Hannah Tinty. Our programs, presented at the Getty Center in Los Angeles, are recorded by Phil Richards. Our theme music is David Peterson's That's the Deal, performed by the Deerdorf Peterson Group. Major support for Selected Shorts has been provided by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2011 by Geraldine Brooks. Additional support has been provided by Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the Henry Nears Foundation, Seedlings Foundation, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts has also been supported in part by the New York Community Trust Program for Performing Arts Groups, an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, and with public funds from the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency. Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible by the PRI Program Fund. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.